The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Now we see it, hear it, receive and maintain it. This is our intention when we begin listening to a Teisho. To see the Dharma, to hear it, to receive it and maintain it. And on the teacher's side, the intention is to show it, to say it, to transmit it, and to entrust it. I'm using the language here of transmission because every Teisho is a kind of transmission. And if we all live up to this intention that we declare in the Gatha on opening the sutra, to receive and maintain the Dharma, then we all become Dharma holders. Transmission is not something that just happens between teachers. It happens throughout sanghas. See it, hear it, interesting. Why those two? The ancient Chinese teachers used to say that there was teaching with words and without words. And the teaching without words could include something like holding up the staff, which was a larger version of today's katsu, or zhuzhers holding up one finger. Sometimes it included sounds, so teaching with sounds but not words, snapping the fingers, clapping the hands, banging the floor with the staff. And the classic example for me is showing the hosu. And not just for me, it's discussed that way by many of the teachers, holding up this fly whisk that Melissa described to us. This slender wand with a tassel of horsehair, a ceremonial version of a fly whisk. And this leads us into our koan, which includes holding up the hosu. This already, I think, was a traditional gesture and full of meaning. Let's look into this together. I'm going to read to you from a different translation. This is the one that we use in our Boundless Way Zen Koan curriculum. And some of the spellings are different and some of the pronunciations are a bit different, but it's all the same, people and places, don't worry. So transmission of light, case 35, the 35th ancestor, Shito Sichian. The 35th ancestor, Shito Sichian, came to Qingyuan. The ancestor asked him, "Where do you come from?" The master said, "From Shaoqi." The ancestor lifted up his whisk, lifted up the hosu, and said, "At Shaoqi, is there this?" The master said, "Not only no such thing at Shaoqi, but also there is none in India." The ancestor said, "You haven't been to India, have you?" The master said, "If I'd been there, that would be there." The ancestor said, "That is not sufficient. Try again." The master said, "Your reverence must take one part of the expression. You should not have me speak alone." The ancestor said, "I won't refrain from speaking, but probably no one will acknowledge it." The master said, "Acknowledging is not improbable, but no one dares to speak." The ancestor struck him with his whisk. At that instant, the master attained deep realization. And the poem, "With one lifting, hundreds and thousands are lifted. Even a single hair has never been out of it." So, David Roshi yesterday encouraged us to find our way into koans partly by identifying with the various characters, by feeling our way into them. What was it like for them? Who was this person as presented to us? And not just major characters, but minor characters when there are such. Animals when there are animals. Sometimes inanimate objects when there are inanimate objects giving us the teaching of the insentient. And I have been doing this with our koan. And I found myself especially feeling my way into Shito, who many of us just spent 2 weeks with. And now we're spending this one more week considering together the story of the transmission to Shito of the Dharma. And I've been resisting some of the metaphors that have been coming up about ping pong and fencing because I don't see it that way. I feel that there are some deeply emotional things happening and that the pace is slower. Let me see if I can bring that out and just add one more different reading, one more different understanding to the ones that we're developing. Not so that you can adopt mine, but so that you can continue to open up yours. So it's been established that this was not the first conversation between Shito and Xin Yuan. And David referred to some earlier conversations between them. Melissa mentioned some too. And so interesting that he starts this dialogue by saying, "Where do you come from?" Which a question which could lead to various kinds of answers. Interesting that the master says from Cao Chi. I think now it's possible that this was for dramatic reasons, for storytelling reasons. Let's start with that. I don't think so, though. I don't think only that. I think it's quite significant that the koan starts this way. Because Cao Chi has a lot of resonance in this koan and in the story of Shito. And again, Melissa Roshi gave us a lot of that earlier in her talk. And just to touch back on a couple of points, I want to emphasize that Shito came to Cao Chi when he was just 13 or 14 years old. What a tender age. And there he found this amazing teacher, Wei Nong, who was the last ancestor of us all, the last ancestor of all living Zen teachers and practitioners. And after this odd beginning of his teaching career, became a great and renowned teacher. The reason the platform sutra has a platform in it, the reason Shito was up on a platform, is because 10,000 people came to hear him speak. And this teacher, who 10,000 people would come to hear, clearly took an interest in Shito. Took him aside towards the end, or accepted his desire for an interview towards the end, and told him one or maybe two things that proved important for him, sent him on to his own successor, Xin Yuan. And so I can't help but imagine that Shito comes to Xin Yuan with a strong emotional connection, still to Shito, even though Shito is dying or is dead by now, and still to Cao Chi. And so this question, where do you come from? Wow. really touching the tender spot. I want to delve into this a little bit more, this matter of coming from one center of practice and going to another, coming from one teacher and going to another. Because I know it's something that many of us have experienced. I know this from getting to know you, that I believe most of us began our Zen life somewhere else with a different teacher or teachers. Or perhaps it was a different form of Buddhism and a different teacher or teachers. And this is quite common. In America, we move a lot, but we also hold out for what we really need. And we move on a lot. This is what we do. And this is what I've done. And so there's a special resonance for me with this koan. I started out at San Francisco Zen Center, also at a young age. I was not 14, but I had just turned 18, so not many years older than Shito. Very idealistic. Very determined to be a monk. And for various reasons, it didn't work out. And, you know, I gave it my all. I was taught a way of sitting there that really goes back to Shito's stone sitting. To sit absolutely still, absolutely unmoving, 40 minutes at a time. Four times a day if you were up to it, and I was up to it. And at the end of about a year, it was clear it just wasn't right. And so I moved on. And unlike Shito, it took me 30 years, more than 30 years, to find my next teacher. Or teachers, because I came to Boundless Way Zen. And I first studied with James Ford, who was the third founding teacher with David and Melissa, and in the American way, moved back to California some years ago. So no longer with us, but with us. And I sat week after week with James and others in West Newton, near where I lived. And I loved it. It was the Dharma home I had wanted. But I realized, looking back, that in a lot of ways I hadn't left San Francisco in terms of my practice. So I would go week after week to West Newton, and I would do this rock-like sitting I'd been taught, unmoving, always in quarter lotus, because I couldn't do half lotus. But those were the only acceptable ways to sit in San Francisco. No seizin, God forbid a chair. Very, very strict, very high soto, if you can say that, high church soto. And I did that. And I sat still and unmoving, and I counted my breaths, because that's what I've been taught. And this is stupid. I never went to Doksan. There was James Ford. I didn't go to Doksan with him, because in San Francisco, we really didn't have Doksan. You had to be quite an advanced student to get to go. This idea of Doksan three times a day, amazing. In San Francisco, maybe once or twice a year if you were a first-year student. So I lost all these opportunities. But you know, maybe there are no mistakes, as we've been wondering. So I think it's fair to say that even though I was in West Newton, even though I was with Boundless Way Zen, in some ways my heart was still in San Francisco. I had left my heart mind in San Francisco. And then I did my first sesshin with Boundless Way Zen. And it was this sesshin. It was a week-long summer sesshin, the last one we had at Synexit House. Paul was there. I think it was Paul's first sesshin, too. We two go back. And it's when I really got to know David and Melissa. It started to. I think I'd seen them before, but I didn't know who they were. And the first 3 days, there were three teishos, one by James, one by David, one by Melissa. I don't know what order. I think maybe James went first. He liked to do that. And at the end of that third day, I said to myself, oh my God, how did I find this place? How can there be three teachers like this in one sangha? This has to be the best kept secret in Zen. Why aren't there 10,000 people out there? I really thought that. I still think it. We're so fortunate. And you know, there I was doing my San Francisco style sitting. Not moving. Quarter lotus every single period. God, I was in pain. But I was not going to move. And I didn't. And then I started doing Doksan. I mean, I was at Sesshin. I kind of had to. We didn't have to, but if you were a new student, you were supposed to meet each teacher at least once. And so I went to Doksan with Melissa. This was like 17 years ago, so close to me still. And Melissa said, where are you from? Kind of, you know. She invited me to show her my mind, which is what you do when you meet a teacher. And I'm sure I told her about San Francisco because that was my calling card. Well, I was at San Francisco's inside. And Melissa listened to me and then she said, well, why don't you start working on a koan? She knew I told her I'd been sitting with James for 9 or 10 months. So she said, why don't you start working on a koan while you're here? And I said, oh no. No, I'm really Soto Zen. Koans aren't something I'm interested in. I just sit. You know, there I was. Still, not just a foot, a whole leg in San Francisco. And Melissa very gently persisted. No, I think you should try it. And then she said, you know, a week-long sesshin is a really good time to start koan work. So I thought, well, I'm not going to be perverse. And so I agreed. And she gave me the mu koan. And what an amazing week that was. Sitting with James and David and Melissa, working with Mu, doing lots of Doksan. Now I'm doing Doksan every chance with everybody. And and I wasn't in. I wasn't in San Francisco anymore. I was here, and I'm still here. So, I think what Qingyuan wants to know is Shito still in Shaoqi? Is he here? Is he ready to be here? And so, where have you come from? From Shaoqi, right? So literally true. And maybe Qingyuan knew about Shito even before Shito left Shaoqi. There would have been lots of communication back and forth. Shaoqi was the mothership for this Zen line. Maybe he'd heard about this kid, this amazing young guy that came at 14 and had been noticed by Wei Nan. But he asked the question, and Shito says, from Shaoqi. And so Qingyuan does this teaching by holding something up, right? Now we see it. He holds up the hosu. He holds up the fly whisk. And here again is where the ping pong doesn't work for me. I think there's a long pause at this point. This is how I dream my way into this koan. Qingyuan is holding up the hosu, and I think he holds it for a while, waiting to see what Shito will do. And then says that this really loaded question, given everything Shaoqi means to both of them. Is there this at Shaoqi? At Shaoqi, is there this? Where are you? Where are you right now? Is there any place outside this place for you? And then, you know, for me, Shito still must be pretty young, because this is a kind of young person's over-the-top, ballsy answer, if I can use that word. Not only no such thing at Shaoqi, but there is also none in India. India seems to come in from nowhere, but it's been there all along. When Shito holds up the fly whisk, when he holds up the hosu, this goes all the way back, keeping in mind that this is a koan about the transmission of the light. This goes all the way back to the first transmission from Shakyamuni to Mahakashyapa, when Shakyamuni doesn't say anything. He holds up a lotus flower and twirls it. Now we see it. And so not only not here, but not in India. It's as though Shito is running back through the whole lineage, back through 6 Chinese ancestors before Qingyuan, back through 27 Indian ancestors, back to Shakyamuni. And all of that, just here, nowhere else. No Shaoqi, no India. And then there's some more interesting back and forth. And having gotten us to India, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do what we were told yesterday we always do. I'm going to jump to the end and say something about the way that this koan returns to the hosu, for the fly whisk. Some back and forth that isn't seeming to get us very much further. Shito, in that first, that answer, not at Sauchi, and also none in India, has really swung for the fences. And as baseball fans know, that's not always a good idea. Swing and a miss. And again, you know, I like baseball better than ping pong here. It's slower paced. I want to slow the koan down for us. And then more, you know, it's not three strikes and you're out. In his great compassion, Qin Yuan keeps trying. Try again. This is not a battle. This try again is not mocking. It's coming from a place of deep compassion. Try again. And then at the end, the ancestor struck him with his whisk. At that instant, the master attained deep realization. I don't want us to get confused by the word struck and think that, oh, this is the beginning of shouts and blows in Zen teaching. That's going to come with Shito's great contemporary Matsu a little bit later. This is not a blow. The fly wisp, the hosu, is made of a slender wand that has some flexibility in it. Think of a fly swatter. Except that the hosu isn't made to swat flies. It's got the horse hair tassel on it that's meant to brush them away without hurting them. Right? The Zen teacher's conviction, the Zen teacher's commitment to ahimsa, to non-harm, would not allow swatting the fly. You've probably all seen a horse using its tail to brush flies away. That's the model for the hosu, for the horsehair fly whisk. Same thing, right? So we take a little bit of the horse and put it on the end of a slender wand. So the hosu literally wouldn't hurt a fly. This is not a blow, not even like a blow with arkotsu, let alone the staffs that they used to use back then. Or would start, they hadn't used them yet. This starts with matsu. That's still to come, very, very soon. So this gentle whisk, what is, here's something I would like to leave you with. What is Qin Yuan whisking away? There they are, together, finally. Qin Yuan's been pulling Shito there. They're in that place where fundamentally nothing is acquired. We've been talking about this as a koan about transmission, and I talked a little bit earlier about the transmission going on here now. Now we see it, hear it, receive and maintain it. But as I suggested in my last talk to the residency group Friday, I'll say this again for all of us, that transmission's a little bit confusing because literally the words would suggest sending something across, transmitting something, sending something across. But in this kind of transmission, it's already there. And so I suggested maybe we should think of it as getting something across. Getting across that you already have what you need. That the family treasure doesn't come in through the gate, as Wu Men tells us at the beginning of The Gateless Gate. That nothing was ever missing, not a single hair was ever missing. In that seeking it yourself with empty hands, you return with empty hands. So what needs to be brushed away for that to happen? With one lifting, hundreds and thousands are lifted. Even a single hair has never been out of it. Thank you. Please, let's make our horseshoe. I'm using a horse metaphor because we were talking about horses' tails. And sit comfortably, if you're not already, or if you wish to. And whatever's coming up for you, whether it seems to be related to the Teisho or not, David and Melissa and Michael and I will all attempt to meet you. And I see a hand. Yes, Steve.
Thank you for the talk, Alan. So interesting, so many things to pursue. But I think what comes up for me is this interplay between what I'm going to call the explicit and the implicit. So there's the explicit words that are exchanged between the two men. And we get a little bit of the implicit, the action. You know, what's happening, the nonverbal, you know. And we sort of have to guess a bit at the implicit and begin to fill in with our own mind's eye. And I think that what happens, at least for me, you know, is that it's like the implicit becomes the color within the
within the
generalized form that's being painted by the explicit. So anyway, I just wanted to say that these koans are lovely, lovely pictures.
Yeah, and you know, for me they're also jewels, and especially in the way that. And this is a way that I talk about poetry too, in the way that as you turn them different ways, you know, you see different kinds of radiance in them, and different glints and different colors, different colored lights. You know, think of the most interesting diamond you've ever looked at, and all the different colors and lights it had, and yet it doesn't have just anything, you know. And so for me, the wonderful thing about getting to hear, you know, five Teishos, other than mine, and a whole series of encouragement talks, is to get to keep seeing different glints and colors as different teachers turn it different ways, and as you all respond in Dharma dialogue and show your, and you know, turn it your way. Yeah, so let's keep turning that jewel.
I love what you said about we can only guess at the implicit, right? We can also only guess at the explicit. But I think what we may have felt, or I felt in Alan's talk, is how to make the entry into the personal, right? That you are all the people in the koan, you know, and whether it's explicit or implicit, you know, there's a saying that the Shakyamuni had only two ways of talking, explicit and implicit, two levels sometimes they were called. That's true for all of us. And these koans, my experience of them, because I do them over and over and over again with people, is, and you know, this is one example, but also in Doksan, the constant stretching of the sense of who these people were. They really are us. But we're all multifaceted, multicolored, multi-jeweled too. So it's endless. You can turn one koan, the Mu koan, I'm still practicing with it. It's endlessly evocative of everything. So, yeah. So I really affirm what you're saying, and thank you.
You said picture. That just stuck out for me because the Impressionists, when they painted, they painted a picture of a house, But the whole idea was what you as the viewer would walk away from in this. Because the viewer and the painting create the art. It's not one way. It's not trying to discover what are they trying to say. It's what's here when you experience it.
Rich.
This kind of reminds me of your Dharma talk during residency last year, where you spent more time on your early days, which I love Dharma biographies. But and there was resonance for me, and I was very moved by it. I think you were moved by saying it. But what struck me was you came, you know, like 3 decades later, holding on to the way you were at San Francisco Zen Center, and you know, this is the way they practice. But of course, that's the way they practice then. Mm-hmm. Who knows?
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Didn't practice that way.
They don't do 40-minute periods anymore.
Yeah. And they probably do Dokusan. And then some resonance for me, because like a lot of us coming from another tradition, and I didn't feel like I've been holding on. But then I see, I hold on, I compare, I think about this and that. And, so just some resonance. And in line with that, what you said last night really helped me when you talked about resistance is futile. And give up that carefully curated set. I'm trying to figure out what I've been curating. But anyway, it was great.
Thank you. Will.
Thank you for the talk and for letting me speak. I found it very moving. I sort of want to bring it down to the body.
Sure, could you speak up just a little?
Sure, yeah. So I started thinking I was going to talk about one example, and then another one immediately came to mind. So let's see. You know, having been an officer a number of times for Sesshin, I think sort of mixed feelings about it. I like having a role, I like being useful, and at the same time I don't like talking and listening to talk as much. I find it makes me a little anxious. There's always the opportunity in an officer's meeting to be told in some detail what you didn't do well, or you know, what was the departure from the form. Anyway, it's just about me. I'm a somewhat anxious person, and I roll with it, and it's fine, and I'm happy to keep serving, and I think it's good for me. But this morning something happened, which was I was sitting as waiting for the meeting to start, and someone came in and sat next to me, and their body sort of touched mine briefly just in the act of sitting down, and I suddenly thought, oh, okay, I was holding a lot of tension that I didn't realize I was holding, and then I felt, and it may have been imaginary, but I felt this great kind of calm coming from this person to me. And again, it might have been anybody, but maybe it was something in them. But I just suddenly realized that I had been nervous, and I didn't need to be as nervous as I was. And it just got me thinking about both the physical, the body, and also about different modes of being with people. And it brought to mind the fact that I find it very difficult, and I may not be the only person, to meet the teacher's eyes in Dokusan. Hmm. There's something really, it brings up my making self, right? So I start to make a self when I'm looking someone in the eyes. And yet it's also the tremendous honesty and exposure, which is, you know, both deeply touching and scary, you know. And then I guess the other anecdote, just to make it connect a little better here with what you said, was my first Dokusan at Boundless Way, and that was with Melissa Roshi.
And we do have to be careful. I know as teachers we tell
it's
stories
okay.
about
I think it's okay. It's, yeah. I think it's okay.
Because Dokusan is confidential.
Yeah. This is really about, like, I said my shoulders are hurting and you gave me some advice about the shoulders. Can I say that? So
I guess
we
did.
We moved on. You already said it.
Okay. Sorry.
That's
it's
okay.
not, it didn't seem like it was. It
that
just,
ship has sailed.
It really, it was kind of, you know,
yeah.
welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
And she said something to me that was about, that was very understanding. She saw me and sort of saw that, you know, understood that there were ways I was holding my body and that that had something to do with me and my life. I mean, without the detail, it's a little hard to go into,
mm-hmm.
but I felt really seen and understood,
mm-hmm.
and I relaxed.
Yeah.
It was the first time I'd been meeting with a teacher in a new Zen center. And I was scared. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know how to do the bows. I didn't know anything, right? And I felt like, oh, you know, not only does she have practical advice about where my body hurts, she understands why a person like me might have that pain.
So
it's the human contact, I guess, just really, really resonated.
Yeah, and there's that fly whisk.
Yes, that's it. That was the caress. That was what I thought
of.
That was
and two things that I heard, and one is, you know, let go of hundreds of years and relax completely.
Yeah.
Right? This is one of the invitations that's alive for us at this retreat, sitting with Shito. Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. But also, you know, when you talked about your nervousness and anxiety and said, so I roll with it, I want to say, when we're in a state like that, roll in it. You know, just really go with it. That this is a place to practice, and not something to get through. And that's all I have to say. Esther had a hand up before.
So I'm rolling in tears as response to everything. Sorry. thank you so much for your talk. I was really touched when you spoke about, I'm going to cry again, about sitting in lotus posture and just holding the posture and being in so much pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I instantly got, you know, also flashbacks from showing up in Dokusan without going into detail, but of that compassionate response to what it is that we do to ourselves in our lives when we come in and we show ourselves to the teacher.
Mm.
And then my mind went to all the places and forms where we hold ourselves tightly.
Sorry, can you speak it to
yes.
something now? I apologize.
Well, no, it's even
yeah.
up here.
So,
it's hard.
One thing is to have been in a Zen school or a spiritual tradition before leaving that and going to a new place and not having left that place just yet.
Mm-hmm.
But my mind went to all the places where we've been before fully in something and then realizing we haven't left those places or those forms or those relationships or whatever it may be.
Yeah, and you know, how do we hold these forms in a way that's not rigid? You know, it looks that may look from the outside rigid. I mean, after all, we make this commitment to sitting still and unmoving. So how do we do that in a way that inside it is really loose and has that quality of relaxing completely? And it, you know, I think most of us know that can be done. Maybe not every period, but we can find our way there.
Mm.
Yeah, Deb.
Thank you so much for the talk. So it brought up some history for me about my first Zen Center was the Rochester Zen Center, which the people know it was started by Philip Kaplow, who wrote The Three Pillars of Zen. And it was, I mean, he trained in Japan, and it was so strict that the rounds were 35 minutes, 7-minute kinis, all the sessions were 7 days. So you start off with a 7-day session. I'm getting like chills remembering. And it was so hard, but I was 19, so it was, you know, it was so hard, but, you know, it was also incredible. But I remember Joksan was, you had to run to get to the line. It was a line. And if you didn't make it to the line, you had to go back to the Zendo, and you didn't get a chance. There was this horrible feeling of like, anyway, it was not fun. And I was so scared, and Doksan, like, just petrified, like, just in, anyway, and it was a very patriarchal kind of place. But eventually, the Roshi gave transmission to Toni Packer, and she became my teacher, and that was much better. But again, you know, things changed, and she decided that she didn't really want to keep to the forms of Buddhism. And even though I loved working with her, you know, I was sad about leaving Buddhism behind, but you know, you're young, you don't know what to do, you just stay with it. Anyway, so that's where I met Matt, and we got married, and you know, we had children, and that became our practice. And then a few years ago, coming to Boundless Way was just fabulous, you know, so I just feel so grateful for how, you know, the forms are here, but there's this openness, and, you know, although I was a little scared of David the first few times.
Yeah, we all are.
I'm still scared of David. I mean, look at him. You know.
and you know,
it was like this old stuff, you know, this old stuff. Yeah. It's still old stuff, like, oh, I shouldn't sit in a chair, and I felt in the residency, I got permission, I hurt my hip, and got permission to sit in a chair. It's like, oh, sitting in a chair is Zazen too, you know?
Right.
So it's...
And Deb, you always have permission. Everyone always has permission to sit in a chair. And you know, these stories that we tell, in some ways it sounds like we're saying those were the bad old days, but that's not what I'm hearing, really, which is that was not wasted time, right? And it got you here. And I hope I didn't give anyone the impression that the time I spent at San Francisco was wasted time. I'm so grateful for it. Even though it didn't work out, and even though there were things really wrong with the place, I'm so grateful for it. So,
well, it did kind of work out.
Well, I mean, that's what I
mean.
You
are. Look right
here. That long term, it works out.
I have my fly whisk.
It's our right. It's our karma led us here.
Yes.
And, and I want to just speak specifically to that because I've been through my own journey. Right. My first teacher was a student of Philip Kaplow, who took everything very seriously. David and I both started in that tradition, and the herd of people trying to get out the door to Doksan is one of my, you know, I've had to work with that as a trauma, because I still have a vision of this lovely man who was the husband of a very close friend of mine, and I had to turn back because everybody, there were 3 seats, you got to fill the seats with, you know, 30 people in the room, and he was like, an insane person. His eyes were wild, his mouth was frothing, and I thought, wait a minute. So part of Boundless Way Zen is I'm going to take responsibility for taking that experience, which had many wonderful things in it. I mean, my teacher had definite issues, the guy who was Philip Kaplow's student, but he also taught me so much, and it goes to what Esther was saying. You know, oh, and I did some yoga stuff at some point with some very bizarre, it all feeds in to what we're doing here. Because one of the things that I was determined to do once I became a teacher, and it's one reason I chose James Ford as my second teacher, is to not replicate what I learned from that other teacher. But to absorb the Dharma that I received, I really did receive Dharma from him. I really did, like you did from Tony and like you did from Philip Kaplow. And everybody who's ever, we've ever encountered, right? And some of them were not gentle, right? Really not gentle. And on one level, yeah, so we are still at Saoshi. We really are. We can't escape our past, but we can use the ingredients of that to create a tastier meal. Right. And it is kind of wonderful. Why aren't there 10,000 people here? Partly it's because I think we don't make a big deal out of how wonderful we are. We're not on social media. We don't have. We have podcasts. And we have all. But you know, we're not. We're not. We're not promising enlightenment in a weekend like some people do. We're just doing this practice that we've inherited from our ancestors, and Shinto is our direct ancestor through Qingyuan to Weinan. And it's so touching to me to read his stuff and go, oh yeah, I know that because I've been practicing that for 40 years. So yeah, everything. Just had to say that. Thank you. Also, David is not really scary.
No, I know that.
You know that, and I think maybe not everybody knows it, but definitely look forward to your doksans.
Well, I mean, is that true?
We can
say, oh yeah, this person, oh, they're so this or they're so that. But each one of you, I know, is quite a wild person when you, at different times, and all of us. And I hope everyone is scared of me.
So let's keep this going a bit, but maybe everyone can try to be concise so that a couple more voices can be heard. Bix.
Yeah, I was for anybody who knows me a little bit, I've been to a few different. I started here, and I've been to a couple other places. I've lived at Great Pound Zen Monastery in Oregon. I've lived at Zen Mountain Monastery for brief periods in upstate New York. And I feel very much that, like, I still have pieces of me there. And especially Great Vow, I guess, I went there when I was really just starting out. I'd only been practicing for a few months. And that place totally just, like, cracked me open. Like, totally just broke my heart open and changed me probably forever. And I'm here, and then I'm also still there. And I received so much from those places. And, I might go back one day. Mm-hmm. That's what you said, Catherine, just because it's nice to have those experiences of, like, somewhere that, and this place, of course, is really, really close. We have those places up too.
Well, and I think all of this is circling around where Steve started us with the color. You know, we bring our whole lives. We don't leave anything behind. And some things haunt us and are so difficult, and other things are sources of joy. But as Melissa was saying, it's all, we need to bring it all. Not one thing can be left out or needs to be left out. And the richness of the color of the koan is from your whole life. When you allow everything, when you don't have to sort, well, these are the good things that happen to me, these are the bad. All of it gets to be here and is here. And we simply recognize, oh yes, all of it.
Dave.
Yeah, I was moved by your talk, by the open-heartedness of your talk, and
just speak up.
Sorry. Yeah, and what I love this notion of that it's not ping pong, that it's this kind of loving interaction. And so what came to me is I didn't start out at a different Zen center, but when I was a kid, I used to play a lot of ping pong with my dad. And we played all, and it's one of my fondest memories of my childhood. So when we played, there was deep love between us. Deep love both ways, even though we were playing ping pong. So I thought maybe you guys could both be, or everybody could be right. And maybe we don't even need always a different facet. Maybe one facet is kind of like purple. It's like red and blue at the same time, so we can see both.
Yeah, thank you, Dave. And Orin, I think, Annie, you've had your hand up for a while. Annie, and then Orin, and then we'll finish.
Okay. Well, I thought the talk is really beautiful, and I too have had a day where, you know, I think in dawn I was already getting teary. So I'll try to speak, because I felt like part was so beautiful is like the teacher is so skillful in how he's sort of like. My image, even though it's not quite right, but also that action of like, and what people try with like fly fishing to like, you know, sort of, it's gentle, yet, I mean, yes, it is predatory, but there's something about the action and that also, as a teacher, I think of the ways where I've tried, you have to be so skillful because how do you lead, how do you help the student kind of, you know, sort of, yes, participate and become fully like who they can be. So your description of what happened between the two men, I just thought was really beautiful in terms of what the teacher was doing.
Yeah.
You know, I would like to answer that, or respond to that question with a ping pong story. So my dad and I also played ping pong together, but we never kept score in the purpose of the game was to keep the ball going. We never cared about one smacking it in. We weren't really good, but we just keep it going. How long can we keep it going? And that's to me this ping pong essence of the Dharma, the Dharma between these two. It's just let's keep this going.
Your comment made me remember another. I think Alan's talk was so evocative for all of us of past teachers, past Doksans, all of it. So that, it's not surprising that it's coming up. But when I first started working with my first teacher, I couldn't understand why we were doing what we were doing. It just seemed crazy to me, and it also seemed like, what was he getting out of it? You know, so one day I said to him, like, is this a scam? what the heck? And he was really stopped in his tracks, and he said, no. And I'm doing this because I love the Dharma so much, and I want to transmit it to other people. And I didn't believe him. I thought he was really full of crap. But then as time went on, and then I became a teacher myself, I realized that's all I want. You know, I don't want fame, I don't want money. I mean, it's good to have some money to pay for groceries and the mortgage and all that. But what I want is a community of people who understand what I'm talking about just a little bit and respond to it. And, you know, these are my heart companions, right? You're my heart companions. But you don't have to be anybody else. I think this is the theme we're going for here. You have to be some other person, right? To you already are a Buddha. A friend of mine who's a Theravadan monk, I was telling one of you this, said he had met a Nichiren Buddhist 30 years ago who said to him, Nichiren is a cousin to Zen, it's another Mahayana group in Japan. And he said to him, you are the stupidest person I've ever met. This is a guy, you know, with his head shaved and his robes and stuff. You are the stupidest person I've ever met. And my friend said, why? He said, because you don't know you're already a Buddha. And God, I just said, yes. That's the feeling. So not a scam and a particular technology of form. that allows these understandings to arise between people.
So last comment, wanna...
Very brief. Your talk was beautiful, but it really felt inclusive. And I'm loving all the imagery, and I loved the soft whisk. That was beautiful. Mm-hmm. And then hearing the ping pong, so all the imagery here. And of course my own past being evoked, and gratitude towards remembering the kind eyes of teacher I couldn't receive, you know. But receiving today, and then when you said, what the point is, get to it, when you said, and are you here? That really touched me, because, you know, I'm here, but sometimes I'm not, but am I, you know, there was just something when you said that, that it was enough, right? That's what I felt. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice place to end. But except first, I just want to say, in case anyone was confused, that it was not my intention to model talking about Duxon. And I'm grateful to Melissa for saying that in this case it was okay, because, you know, I'm a teacher talking about the beginning of a kind of transmission to me in this context. But please don't follow my example. Thank you, everyone. And taking our places, restoring the Zendo.